After 6 months with a new leader, the state's Department of Child Safety is still facing serious challenges. And a new strategic plan is receiving only mild support.
What I really wanted to know was, from the director, what do you need from the community, from the governor, and from the legislature? What do you and your team need in order to succeed?
I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Phil Latzman. Also today on the show, is Arizona well-positioned to transition to clean energy?
New rules to review CEO pay versus you and me.
Plus, there's a new trend that involves teeny tiny houses.
A lot of people want it. A lot of people need it. It's more affordable, and we can get more people into homes.
And we stand on another Valley Hot Corner and find out why a tribe is turning to the radio.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
The state's Department of Child Safety is still hitting serious bumps, and Director Greg McKay is implementing a new strategic plan. McKay has had concerns about reports caseworkers have had to do for both serious and minor cases. He also wants to put into effect more of what he calls objective decision-making.
We need to make sure that our staff are making those decisions based on a certain set of criteria and structured decision-making tools that guide them in those decisions so that they make the right decisions based on the right reasons and not the wrong decisions based on fear or other issues.
Dana Namark, president and CEO of Children's Action Alliance, says she's most encouraged by the fact that there's going to be a strategic plan.
For the first time in 6 months now, we have some focus areas, and I think that's a great first step. One thing I'm concerned about is that there's not enough focus on safely reducing the number of children in foster care and increasing in-home services. We think that really needs to be a top emphasis in order to bring the system back in line to meet children's needs better and create better outcomes for kids.
Are there suggestions you'd have, Dana, on those issues?
Yes, our suggestion is to really focus on the availability of in-home services. The recent Chapin Hall audit noted that in their interviews with 1,000 DCS staff at all levels of the agency, from top management to the field, people universally said that in-home services were not available to them. That is a big gap and a big problem. And so the department needs to focus on partnering with the community providers who provide in-home services and revamping the contracts, making sure services are available, and making sure they are letting their staff know how important in-home services are and that is a good alternative to foster care in many cases.
Does a strategic plan, though, end up resetting caseworkers again? So they were supposed to do something before, now they're supposed to do this. What can be done to make sure they're being used effectively and in a way where they can do their job well and there's also some appreciation for the job they're doing?
Caseworkers having very little direction or inconsistent direction, inconsistent supervision, inconsistent framework for decisions has been a huge problem in recent months and years. So if the strategic plan is done well, it will actually provide more of that focus, that clarity, that consistency that the staff are looking for and that can help them succeed in their jobs. So it really now comes down to implementation. A lot in this plan is still pretty broad and remains to be seen what the decisions and the processes will be. So the community really wants to work closely with the department in moving toward these goals and turning them into reality.
Can the strategic plan that Greg McKay wants to implement, once we know more specifics about it, can it be done? Can it be implemented without significantly more funding from the legislature and the governor?
Well, I thought that was a missing piece of the strategic plan. And what I really wanted to know was from the director, what do you need from the community, from the governor, and from the legislature? What do you and your team need in order to succeed? And I haven't heard clear answers to that, and they do need to answer that, both for us in the community who want to partner and certainly for the governor and the legislature. Clearly, resources will be needed, and some legislators are getting tired of hearing that. But the fact is, the number of families needing help, the number of families in crisis, has been going up. So even though appropriations have been added over the past couple of years, we are not in any way caught up to meet the need. Resources will be needed. The big questions are not only how much, but for what purpose? How are we going to target those resources, and how will they get us to better results for safer, healthier children living with permanent families?
Dana, the agency's establishing new rules by the end of the year because of legislation from last year. And the proposed rules, some of them about reports and investigations, are considered to be a little bit vague. Do you have any troubles with that?
They have just proposed new rules regarding the intake of reports of abuse and neglect. And these proposals are very, very open-ended. And they would give the department themselves the authority and really carte blanche to define what constitutes a report of abuse or neglect and what constitutes an investigation of that report. Those are very fundamental issues that really define the whole CPS system. And we think it's very troubling to have it so open-ended with no parameters that a state agency by themselves could create those definitions and could change them at any time.
Dana Wolf Namark is president and CEO of Children's Action Alliance. Dana, thank you for the update.
Thank you, Steve.
It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Phil Latzman. When it comes to complying with new federal standards for emissions reductions, renewable energy advocates say Arizona's natural resources position the state well in the coming transition. I mean, think about it. When it comes to sunshine, we own it. According to the National Weather Service, and anyone who lives here, Arizona is the sunniest state in the country. And wind? Yeah, we got that too, especially up north in the high country where coal-burning power plants dot the landscape. Could those plateaus be one day occupied by wind turbines instead?
Arizona has tremendous opportunity because we have abundant sun, wind, and energy efficiency, which are our lowest cost energy sources.
That's Amanda Ormond, who is Arizona representative for the InterWest Energy Alliance. It's a nonprofit trade association which helps advocate for clean energy initiatives. Now, in its plan released this week by the president, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency asks that carbon monoxide emissions be cut by 34% in the state by the year 2030. And that's actually a reduction from the original goals set by the EPA.
It's important to note that the EPA really listened to the concerns of Arizona and changed our goal significantly, and it makes it even easier for us to comply with this rule.
Why do you think they changed that requirement so drastically, at least it seems, from over half to just over 30%?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons. Arizona did a good job advocating for itself. Arizona had congressional delegation and state agencies that put together good comprehensive arguments about why the rule language was too stringent on Arizona, and we were successful. The way I look at this rule, Arizona got most of the concessions that it was seeking.
How groundbreaking is this, not only for Arizona, but for the rest of the country, that we have a declaration such as this?
This is an important policy decision for this country to start regulating carbon dioxide emissions. It's the first time that we're attacking climate change emissions.
Why are some of the utilities and regulators concerned about this?
Well, I think Arizona likes to determine its own destiny, as most states do. And any time that the federal government says, you must go this way, there's a normal reaction to say, we'd rather do it our way. The thing that's so positive about this rule is that it creates incredible flexibility for the state to meet the requirement in a variety of ways. So it can reduce its coal generation, it can add natural gas, it can add energy efficiency or renewable energy, or any other creative way that we can reduce carbon.
As a result, could we see energy costs go up?
Well, energy costs are going to go up. We know that. If we did nothing, energy costs are going to go up because most of the energy sources that are available in the future are going to be more costly than those that we've built in the past. The anomaly to that is energy efficiency and wind energy and, in some cases, solar. These are becoming our low-cost resources. So they're not only clean, they're not only carbon-free, but they're lower cost than new fossil generation in many cases.
Since we're in Arizona and right in the middle of the summer, and how is solar factored in? is Arizona ahead of the pack when it comes to solar energy, and what are the obstacles that face the solar energy industry in the state?
One of the opportunities in the rule is that states can actually work with each other and buy energy sources across state lines. That sets up Arizona to have tremendous opportunity for deploying our solar resources. We have some of the lowest cost solar resources in the country. We have abundant land. We have adequate transmission. So we have the opportunity to be able to sell our good resources out of state.
And speaking of resources, another resource that Arizona would seem to have in abundance is wind, as you mentioned. But we don't see a lot of turbines, and perhaps you're in other states and other parts of the country, we see those huge turbines spinning. Is Arizona underutilizing its wind energy capabilities?
Arizona is definitely underutilizing our wind resource. Right now, every utility in the state has a wind project under its belt, a utility-scale wind project. But we have over 10,000 megawatts of potential wind, and right now, wind is only 1% or less of our energy portfolio in the state. One of the positive opportunities is that as the coal fleet ages and retires, that's in the northern part of the state where our wind resource is. So we'll be able to repurpose our transmission from being coal-fired generation to wind generation.
That's Amanda Ormond of the InterWest Energy Alliance. And while environmentalists are applauding the new carbon emissions standards, Arizona's top law enforcement official is not. Attorney General Mark Brnovich filed a stay against the Environmental Protection Agency this week, asking the courts to decide on its legality first. Brnovich thinks the edict is a federal overreach, and I asked him why.
The EPA is using a four decades old law to radically change our economy. And it will have a dubious impact on the environment while at the same time having a devastating impact on our economy.
Can you expound upon why it will have a devastating effect on both those areas?
Well, we know that states like Arizona are going to have to reduce their CO2 or their carbon output by about 34%. And once again, this is going to have extremely little impact on our overall air quality. And what it's designed to do is to fight greenhouse gases. And so it's not going to affect our air quality. States like Arizona are going to be forced to reduce their carbon emissions by more than 30%. As a result of that, we know that utility rates will go up dramatically. Water rates will go up because it requires electricity to move water in states like Arizona. Folks like the Navajo Nation are going to be costing jobs and employment as a result of these new rules.
The EPA says that they actually lowered their standards for reducing emissions in Arizona.
Well, although they did lower it from 52% to 30%+, that's still going to have a significant impact on Arizona's economy and our utility rates and possibly even create brownouts in the future. But the second issue is whether the EPA even has the authority to do so. We know that they're relying on a four decades old law that wasn't even meant to address carbon emissions.
So if Arizona could do this itself, if you could address the need to cut down on emissions, do you think it could? The state could do something by itself and not need the EPA to tell it?
Well, historically, that's what's happened, and we know that states like Arizona are already doing that. We know that we've reduced our emissions, and so it's already happening.
That is Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich, one of 16 states to have filed similar stays against the EPA's ruling this week. Now, as for the utilities, the power companies, we did receive a release from one of them, the Salt River Project, or SRP, which reads in part, quote, "While it is too soon to determine what specific actions SRP must take to comply with the new rules, the requirements are significant, will likely affect the future use of current generation resources, and will make it more challenging to permit and operate new or modified resources." SRP also added that given the rules' complexity and their potential impacts, litigation is anticipated. The EPA has extended the compliance period by 2 years to 2022.
Complexities around tribal law and U.S. federal law are nothing new, but the recent Supreme Court ruling on same-sex marriage has led some to call for Congress to potentially step in. To get clarification on which authority applies where and when, we called attorney Stephen Pivar, author of The Rights of Indians and Tribes. Stephen, how complicated can the differences between tribal and federal law get?
Indian law is very different. For example, I just got off the phone maybe half an hour ago with a person employed by an Indian tribe who was fired in retaliation for filing a grievance against her supervisor for sexual harassment. Now, if she were employed by anybody or anything else, she would likely have a valid claim in federal court under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. But when Congress passed Title VII, it expressly exempted Indian tribes. Indian tribes can give preference in employment to their own members in order to help their members with employment and promotions.
Are there certain legal questions that relate to tribal gaming? Is that a state-by-state situation as it relates to what can be done on the reservation as opposed to other situations? Has that increased some complexity of the law in the past couple of decades?
This is also an example, Steve, of where Indian law is so different from non-Indian law. In 1987, the U.S. Supreme Court decided a case, it's called the Cabazon Band case, in which the court held that because Indian tribes are sovereign or quasi-sovereign, they are generally exempt from federal law, and that unless Congress passes a law compelling tribes to abide by certain federal laws, general laws, then Indian tribes are free to make their own laws and enforce those laws. And in Cabazon Band, the Supreme Court held that that applies to gaming, and that Indian tribes can have any kind of gaming they want, unless Congress should later pass a law restricting their gaming operations. Well, Congress did 1 year later by passing the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act.
Are there certain clashes that occur that maybe in some ways are made worse by this idea that some people have a hard time getting their head around the idea that there is sovereignty when it comes to tribes and that that is different from U.S. federal law?
That's probably the single greatest source of controversy, that under our laws, and this goes back to the earliest days, some of the earliest Supreme Court decisions involving Indians and Indian tribes recognized that because tribes were here first, that the Constitution doesn't place them under general U.S. laws. They entered into treaties. There's nearly 400 treaties with the United States and Indian tribes, virtually all of which confirm and recognize the sovereign powers of Indian tribes. There are simply many people, millions of people, that just fundamentally object to the notion that Indian tribes and Indian peoples may have rights and protections and also certain responsibilities and restrictions that non-Indians don't have. And I see this happening on numerous levels. That we might have in the United States, not two governments, not state and federal governments solely, but a third government, tribal governments. And those tribal governments have inherent powers over their territories and their members.
Stephen Pivar is an attorney. He's the author of the book, The Rights of Indians and Tribes. And coming up Friday night at 6:30, he'll be speaking at the Heard Museum. Stephen, thank you for the time.
My pleasure, Steve. Thanks for calling.
Still ahead, if you can't get the news you need about your community, why not do it yourself?
The radio effort, I believe, can go a long ways to filling a void that neighboring off-reservation media outlets don't really find interesting.
If you build it, they will come. Later on the show.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein with Phil Latzman. Hope your Friday afternoon is going well. We're bringing you more of our community mixed with national stories and international news. Valley weather for tonight. We've got a 20% chance for rain. Blowing dust may be included in that as well. We're expecting lows to be in the mid-80s. And then for tomorrow, looks like we'll have a drying trend with sunny skies both Saturday and Sunday and high temperatures around 106. Currently, it's partly cloudy, relative humidity at 20%, and it's 106 degrees at KJZZ. Meanwhile, in Valley traffic, there's an accident I-10 eastbound at 75th Avenue in the median, and we're seeing a tiny, tiny stretch of moderate slowing on the 51 southbound. That's right around Bethany Home. It's 226.
KJZZ is supported by the Saturday Concert Series at Paradise Valley Community College, continuing at 6 p.m. on Saturday, August 8th, with an evening in Brazil featuring Grupo Liberdade and the Samba AZ Dancers. Video at pvcclive.com.
It's the show on this Friday afternoon. I'm Phil Latzman.
And I'm Steve Goldstein, along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry.
On this day, when the 5.3% unemployment rate stays steady and U.S. employers hired a larger than expected 215,000 workers in July, a discussion about CEO pay and what it means for the notion of equity in the U.S. economy. Do CEOs care if you know how much they make? Do CEOs care if their lowest paid employees know how much they make? Does the person who maintains the edit software over at Discovery Communications, for instance, care that CEO David Zaslav makes $156 million? Do shareholders of that company care? The Securities and Exchange Commission is betting yes that shareholders need to know the ratio of the highest paid employee to the lowest paid staffers. The average is 300 to 1 today, and not so terribly long ago, in 1965, it was 20 to 1. 3,800 publicly traded companies will now have to share that pay ratio starting in 2017, according to this SEC rule. Deborah Lifshay is a managing director in the New York office of Perlmeyer & Partners, a firm that specializes in executive compensation consulting.
It's interesting to address the question, do people care to see what the CEO makes? You know, this data has been available for many years now. What's new is trying to track and locate who the median employee is in a corporation that has hundreds of thousands of workers, and then trying to figure out that employee's compensation and then relate it back to the CEO's compensation, two drastically different individuals doing two drastically different jobs.
But does it matter that a company is maybe 400 to 1 in its ratio of median employee or lowest paid employee to the highest paid employee versus a 20 to 1, 10 to 1? Does it bespeak a certain efficiency, equity?
The problem is it's not an apples to apples comparison. Every company will have drastically different ratios because every company has drastically different workforces. Also, the reality is every company can use a different statistical sampling. If you dig down to what this number is actually showing, it's not as meaningful as what the intent was and what the public thinks it will be because of the way that companies are required to gather the information and use the statistics.
Well, how do CEOs decide how much they're going to get paid, or how do companies decide how much to pay their CEOs? Because in many cases, the CEO is on the board and has a little bit of input into how much his or her salary is going to be.
I mean, that's true that they have input, but over the years, there's been, you know, a whole statutory regime of rules regarding compensation committee independence. And in fact, while the CEO may have some input, the actual decisions are made by an independent compensation committee, which consists of no employee or executive member of any company. So in theory, these decisions are independent, and the CEO does not have that much input into his pay.
How does this consulting business work? I mean, you know, excuse me, but once you get past, say, $30 million a year, I mean, how do you make an intelligent argument about, no, actually, he needs $100 million, or she needs $150 million? I mean, I just don't – once you get past a certain level of money, it just seems – like you're talking in the complete abstract.
Well, you know, a lot of it, we start, the square one is you start with a peer group. You look at what other companies are paying. And there are certainly certain instances where some executives are paid more than others in order to attract or retain a certain candidate or incumbent. Where a lot of the money does come from, though, is not actual, you know, salary and cash being paid on an annual basis. It's the, you know, the stock options or the restricted stock that was issued earlier on, perhaps in a career, and is now paying off. But if it's paying off on behalf of the CEO in terms of stock price appreciation, it should be similarly benefiting all of the shareholders of that corporation.
You mentioned the peer group being a determinant of how much people get paid. Is this a market-based number here? I mean, why is there any need to pay anyone $100 million to perform in a company?
Again, you have to attract and retain and motivate talent. You know, the executive team at a very large company needs to be motivated to stay and perform. And again, a lot of that.
But $20 million isn't going to motivate. $100
well,
million is the only thing.
A lot of that $100 million or $20 million that you see that's reported is not actual pay at the outset. It's pay based on performance. So if the company has achieved and they've grown in terms of their financial components or their stock price, that's what goes into that. So in theory, shareholders are benefiting at the same, you know, in parity with the CEO's investment in the company.
And of course, that is the theory, and I think, you know, we're doing reasonably well right now on Wall Street. But the debate over income inequality in the United States is never really going to get started. There's not going to be a radical reorganization of executive pay in America because we're committed to this idea that the peer group kind of rules.
I think that's right. And I think this whole concept that disclosure of a pay ratio is going to dramatically impact the way CEOs are paid, you know, may be a little off. I don't think that it's going to result in income equality. What it will result in, really, the unintended consequences is the impact it has on the employee population, who will now see, you know, Joe employee is paid 1 to 500 or some ratio that was always out there, but now your employee base is going to see that, and it's going to be a whole communication process to explain how we got this employee, who we excluded, why, you know, it may look off compared to other companies because maybe we have a large overseas population or a large part-time population, which is included in the calculation.
Without mentioning names and without hopefully putting you on the spot too much, aren't there instances where corporate executive pay is just obscenely out of scale?
I think where people really find that is on, you know, the so-called golden handshake or the packages on for outgoing executives, where you have a severance package set up that's really pay for failure. And that's where the extremes are, and that's where the public outrage is.
Do you believe anything needs to be changed about the current system? Are you satisfied with the way it is right now, that the market is delivering a verdict on executive pay, or should there be some sort of realignment here coming forward?
Well, it's kind of funny. It's, you know, what I believe is irrelevant. It's what the public perceives. And I think, as you mentioned earlier, in times of economic distress, everybody gets very excited about executive compensation and blames the top five executives. Who are the executives who have compensation disclosed? What they don't look at, or, you know, what we don't have access to, are all the other highly paid investment bankers and, you know, people doing these mortgage deals. We don't know their compensation. It's not required to be disclosed. However, if you flip, you know, you flip it and you look at times of, you know, high stock market prices and investors thriving, we don't focus on executive compensation too much.
Deborah Lipshaz, Managing Director in the New York office of Pearl Myers and Partners. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry.
Coming up, urban infill makes a comeback.
Instead of sprawling and going out further and further, people are taking a look at older neighborhoods and seeing, is there potential to open up something here?
That's ahead. It's The Show.
And good Friday afternoon. Hope it's going well for you on this partly cloudy afternoon. Those clouds will stick with us for a little bit longer. There's a 20% chance for rain tonight. And of course, this time of year, that dust storm is always a possibility. We expect lows to be in the mid-80s. And then for tomorrow, looks like the start of a drying trend with sunny skies both Saturday and Sunday, highs around 106. And then by Monday, well, more of the same. Mostly sunny skies with highs around 105. Currently with relative humidity at 20%, it's partly cloudy and 106 at KJZZ. In Valley traffic, an accident I-10 eastbound at 75th Avenue is blocking the HOV lane. We thank you for listening to the show. If you want to hear more of the program, download the KJZZ app to your smartphone. It's 2:35.
KJZZ is supported by the Commemorative Air Force Museum, preserving combat aircraft in flying condition. Warbirds and historic exhibits are displayed indoors. The museum also is available for events. Photos and seasonal ride info at azcaf.org.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The latest unemployment numbers from the Labor Department show further steady, if slow, job growth. 215,000 new jobs were created last month. After declining a bit in June, the unemployment rate held steady at 5.3%, in part as a result of people re-entering the workforce. But the labor force participation rate is still at the lowest level in nearly four decades. So economist Scott Brown with Raymond James says there is still room for improvement.
Traditionally, 5.3% is considered close to what we would consider full-time employment, about where we want to be. But we've had a lot of people exit the labor force over the last few years. A lot of people still on the sidelines who could come back in and take a job.
Brown says he thinks it's likely to be a close call by Federal Reserve policymakers as they consider whether to start raising short-term interest rates next month. The Navy says it plans to post armed guards at reserve centers around the country. Michael Edward Miller of member station WUTC reports the guards are set to be deployed starting just a month after the shootings that killed five military personnel at a facility in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
The Navy will have armed reservists standing watch at 53 of their reserve centers starting August 17th. On July 16th, a gunman's shooting rampage killed four Marines and one sailor at a Navy operational support center here in Chattanooga. The murders sparked a debate about whether soldiers and sailors stationed at bases in the United States should carry firearms to defend themselves in the event of another attack. Regulations prohibit most service members from being armed on base and at reserve centers. For NPR News, I'm Michael Edward Miller in Chattanooga.
Government officials in Mali say suspected Islamist militants are holding several hostages after storming hotels there, including one where United Nations staff members were staying. At least eight people have been killed. The UN peacekeeping mission says a UN employee is among the dead. Army soldiers have surrounded the hotel. This is NPR News from Washington.
In KJZZ News at 2:38, Phoenix-based Sprouts Farmers Market announced new leadership and solid second-quarter earnings this week. As KJZZ's business correspondent Christina Hansen reports, those announcements just weren't enough for Wall Street.
Sprouts Farmers Market took a beating on Wall Street on Friday after its earnings release. Stock prices dropped 10% as some analysts cut their price outlooks and downgraded the stock. All this happened despite Sprouts actually having a decent second quarter. So what soured investors' mood was the fact that Sprouts lowered expectations for its own financial performance for the rest of the year, saying competition in the natural foods industry is getting fierce. Here's what Sprouts COO Jim Nielsen had to say during a call with analysts.
It's primarily coming from our conventional competitors within each geography.
Sprouts also said its CFO, Amin Maridia, has been promoted to CEO. He replaces Doug Sanders, who will now serve as board chairman. Christina Hansen, KJZZ News.
Federal officials have granted a one-year extension of a waiver that exempts Arizona from some provisions of the No Child Left Behind law that covers public schools. The extension announced by the U.S. Department of Education gives the state more time to implement its plans to ensure student success and new Common Core school standards. The government cited the state's efforts to improve student performance in the lowest performing schools. Those efforts include trying to increase family engagement, assess the needs of schools, and setting performance targets for the worst performing schools and students.
Preservationists want to turn the old Works Progress Administration building on the Arizona State Fairgrounds into office and exhibit space. They proposed plans for renovations yesterday. KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan reports these ideas for the 1938 building come from more than a year after it was slated to be demolished.
A year after preservationists stopped wrecking balls from taking down the New Deal-era building, there are no firm plans about what to do with it.
Discussions are continuing. They won't tear it down willy-nilly. They will come back to us and talk about your next steps for possibilities.
Jim McPherson is heading up the effort to save the former Works Progress Administration building. According to him, the group has commitments totaling close to $80,000 and plans to turn the dilapidated structure into office, exhibit, and retail space. The State Historic Preservation Office has expressed interest in moving in once it's fixed up. But Fair spokesman Christy Walsh says that's not enough.
We had hoped to hear a greater level of detail regarding specific commitments, terms of agreements, and obligations from both the financial end, the renovation side, and also the future costs.
She says fair officials have been patient, but the lack of certainty prevents them from moving forward with other ways to use the space to generate revenue. Walsh adds there are no plans to demolish the structure as of now, and fair officials promised preservationists would have fair warning before any bulldozers are brought in. Alexandra Olgan, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Expanded local coverage of arts and culture, early childhood, and healthy aging is made possible by support from Virginia G. Piper Charitable Trust.
What if you've bought into the American dream and you've always wanted a house of your own, but it's too expensive or too big or just seems too far out of reach? You may just be the perfect candidate for a tiny house, and they're catching on. Phoenix will even be the site for a workshop on how to build a tiny house later this month. It's being put on by the Tumbleweed Tiny House Company, whose operations manager is Ross Beck. Ross, can you define what a tiny house is?
It is basically a tiny house under about 200 square feet, usually about 160 to 190, and it's on mounted on a trailer. So they're often called tiny houses on wheels or toes.
People actually can live in a place that small. It seems even the expectations for a house, or can it be used as a tool shed, a workplace, or is it really a live-in house?
What's happened over the last 10 or 15 years is that people have become interested in downsizing as a philosophy and just their own approach. But a lot of it is driven by the cost of housing. And in fact, the cities of New York and San Francisco have changed their building codes so that they now allow building apartments that are only 240 square feet.
Wow.
And the motivation for that is that really a standard studio apartment, it's too expensive for most people in some of the larger urban areas.
Have you noticed a difference in terms of where the people are living? You mentioned a couple of places that have great density and where people are used to and wanting to live in a downtown place. This is still seen as a place that is about open spaces. And even if you can't have open spaces, well, at least you have a little bit of room to spread out. Are you seeing the philosophies taking hold in places maybe you didn't expect it to?
Yes. In fact, the philosophy is taking place everywhere. Some of them are just on the move. We know of some couples that their jobs are as a professional photographer or they write a blog, and they've been traveling for a year. And in fact, their tiny house living is what creates interest by people. And so, yes, we really are surprised that it is everywhere from remote areas to suburbs to closer into the urban areas.
Ross, are there any sort of new innovative developments as it relates to that? I mean, like a super small stove, self-generated energy, that kind of thing?
Well, actually, there has been appliances designed for small spaces for many years because there is the RV industry and there is the marine industry. Mm-hmm. So we're really fortunate that right now there's quite a selection of very safe and tested products out there to put into these smaller homes, these little RVs. Probably the biggest innovation, I would think, is in the thinking of government officials and legislators and stuff. That they're really looking at this to say, gosh, the demand is high. There's a real need for affordable housing. And so we're going to need to change our regulations a little bit to allow these little tiny houses in areas where usually they've had a higher minimum square foot, like 1,000 feet for, quote unquote, a cottage.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the innovation is just the thinking that, wow, a lot of people want it, a lot of people need it, it's more affordable, and we can get more people into homes.
Ross, I've held this question back. What about the plumbing?
Well, you still have to connect to a sewer somewhere, absolutely. The party's great, but somebody has to go through the plumbing. Yeah, so they're designed to fit the different applications that people might do. So if it's being utilized as a recreational vehicle for extended periods of time, there are, throughout the U.S., a network of RV stations so that you could empty out your wastewater and get new propane and water. Or if you put it semi-permanently in an RV park or a mobile home park, there'll be the sewer and gas and electrical connections right there. For people that are recreating and traveling, they might have holding tanks. A lot of them use compost toilets. They seem to be quite popular. And they may have solar or a generator with the option to plug in when they get to their site.
Ross Beck is operations manager for Tumbleweed Tiny House Company. which will be coming with a workshop to the Valley here on August 29th and 30th. Ross, thanks for the information. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Have a great day.
The Fort Yuma Indian Reservation is on the verge of starting its first ever low-power FM community radio station. It's had an online presence, but this is considered a huge step to increase opportunities so more residents will actually hear the programming. Brian Golding is the volunteer vice president of Quetzon Radio, also known by the call letters KUAV. So, Brian, why is this an important step?
Members of the Quetzon community came together to try to find a way to reach out to young folks and young adults and try to get them interested through the use of the internet and, you know, in get them interested in language preservation, tribal history, cultural issues.
Why does radio make sense? How impactful can it be?
One of the things that we had identified as a result of rolling out an internet-based streaming, online streaming radio, was that older adults and elders often don't have access to smartphones and Wi-Fi and home desktop computers from which they could listen to the streamed signal. We realized that we needed a real radio broadcast signal to be able to reach out to a lot of those folks and hopefully help make the connection between the knowledge that many of those folks in our community have and enable them to share it with some of our younger listeners that may be getting most of their exposure through our website and a renewed internet streaming platform.
How important a niche can this fill, and maybe even greater than a niche, as far as its level of importance to people who are going through things that they can actually hear about on the radio? Maybe they can learn something that is really important in their lives as opposed to just sort of some general public stuff out there.
The radio effort that we're embarking on, I believe, can go a long ways to filling a void and sharing information that neighboring off-reservation media outlets don't really find interesting. And so whether it's information about land leasing processes here on the reservation, stories that try to educate people about changes in the American Indian Probate Reform Act, mm-hmm. we can play a big role in that off-reservation media outlets really won't get involved in because, you know, it doesn't really sell advertising.
Is there any controversy associated with it? And if so, could you give me what the issues of concern may be for other people?
There are fears among some small segment about control and what will be said and what will be shared and whether some of the information we might broadcast concerning tribal language or maybe tribal business might be viewed as something that is inappropriate to be shared with somebody who might, you know, not be a tribal member or a resident of the community and happen to be driving by picking up the signal. But I think some of that can be mitigated by something like a college radio model or a model of operation that involves volunteer producers who are responsible for creating their own content and thereby attracting a diversity of viewpoints and shared stories in our community.
Brian Golding is the volunteer vice president of Quetzon Radio on the Fort Yuma Indian Reservation. They're hoping to raise $80,000 and start construction on a broadcast facility in January. Good afternoon. You're listening to The Show, a KJZZ original production mixing news and features from the Valley, the region, national and international news. In Valley traffic, an accident I-10 eastbound at 75th Avenue is blocking the HOV lane. In Valley, weather for tonight should be partly cloudy. There's a 20% chance for rain, and we expect overnight lows to be in the mid-80s. Should be sunny and dry this weekend, at least that's what the forecasters tell us, with highs of 106 both Saturday and Sunday. Currently, we've gotten a little bit cloudy, and it's 106 degrees at KJZZ at 250.
Are you planning to buy a new car this year? Before you trade or sell your current vehicle, consider donating it to support the programs you love here on KJZZ. We'll take it away for free, and you get a tax deduction. To donate, go to cars.kjzz.org, and thanks.
We head now to another Valley Hot Corner, spots with a lot going on. But first, as always, let's meet our tour guide.
I am Gwen Ashley Walters, and I'm a food journalist for Phoenix Magazine.
And where have you taken us today?
We are at The Yard in Central Phoenix.
Specifically on 7th Street north of Missouri at what used to be a motorcycle shop.
It has three restaurants here that are kind of a big draw, plus not to mention the foosball table and the community kind of feeling spot that we have here.
The game room behind us.
Right, yeah. Right. But this little stretch of 7th Street that we're on right now between Missouri and Bethany Home is really a hot, hot strip. Lots of new things coming in.
So what are some of the newer things coming online that you're most excited about?
Sometime this year, a couple of developments, infill redevelopment, we've talked about that before, are coming in. One of them is called The Colony, and it's actually just a little bit south of here. And that's going to have Stock and Stable, which is a new concept from the Clever Koi people that are in Central that do a little bit of an Asian fusion. But this new Stock and Stable is going to be an American gastropub. And also in that same section, the Herb Box is going to open another branch.
So does that project sound, in theory at least, like it's kind of like this one in the sense that there are a few different restaurants under basically one roof?
It does to some degree, although I think it's going to be a little bit more retail and restaurants, not just restaurants. And this is more of like a community hub where we are here at The Yard, because obviously they want people to come and hang out and play and stay. The Colony is going to be more really just beautifully designed, obviously, but it's going to be restaurants and retail.
And there's going to be some newer stuff north of us, right?
Right, correct. Just north of here and on the opposite side of the street, on the east side of the street, will be The Crown, which is an old building that's being redeveloped. And there's going to be at least, I think, three restaurants in there. One of them that we know about for sure is called Okra, and it's a concept from the Crudo people that are in Arcadia.
So why do you think it is that so many of these kinds of places are opening up right along the stretch of 7th Street?
I don't know why they came here. There obviously people feel like there's a good base of customers here in the neighborhoods behind us, but 7th Street is, you know, super busy thoroughfare between...
You can hear it behind us.
You can, and between downtown and up north, delivering people both ways every day. So it's quite a busy area.
That might make it appealing for a restaurant. I mean, you have a lot of traffic going back and forth. And even though it's occasionally at high speeds,
right?
You know, the sign, for example, for The Yard is big enough. You can see it a block or so south of here. Maybe it attracts more people to come in.
Possibly. Yeah, this place especially, because you can see how big it is. And it's kind of... And I think it was the anchor, you know. Well, actually, Otro opened about the same time. They're just a little bit north of Bethany Home. That's the Mexican restaurant from Doug Robson. But I think, you know, that and this yard were kind of like the anchors. And you know that what seems to happen is one place opens and it's successful, other people start looking at it. And I think that the buildings that are being redeveloped right now were just, it was just time. They were built in the, some of them built in the 50s, and they were, it was just time to update them. And the developers probably got great deals.
And this is not a new neighborhood in Phoenix. I mean, 7th Street around Missouri, Bethany Home. I mean, this has been here for a long time. You mentioned some of the houses and other buildings are very old here. So it's not like they're trying to come in and make this area something new and cool and hip. I mean, it's been here a while.
It is, and I think it's still part of that infill redevelopment trend that's going on. Instead of sprawling and going out further and further, people are taking a look at older neighborhoods and seeing, is there potential to open up something here? Because the people are already there, right? So I think this neighborhood is really in transition. You know, now it's got all these very hip, very cool eateries coming on board, and I bet you some of the houses around here are probably going to get remodeled as well.
What's in it for a restaurant or even a developer to have, you know, beanbag toss and foosball and ping pong? I mean, people could come here and not even eat. They could just come and play and maybe have a drink or something. Is that desirable for someone who owns a restaurant?
Yes, I think, especially the drinking part of it.
Depending on what they have.
There's probably a high margin on the alcohol, would be my guess. They're trying to create a community, and they're trying to bring people, give people a reason to come in and stay. You know, not just come and eat and leave. You know, people have discretionary income, and they can spend it in a number of ways. Eating out is one, and then going to a movie. But this kind of helps people say, well, let's just stay here and play. You know, let's
make
play.
A few hours out of it, as opposed
exactly.
to just having a meal and then leaving.
And then leaving, right? Exactly. And it is cool. It's fun. It's very hip right here.
Gwen Ashley Walters is a food journalist for Phoenix Magazine. We met at the Yard on 7th Street between Missouri and Bethany Home in Phoenix.
It is home to many of the East Valley's founding members. The location is one of the oldest in the area, and many of you have driven right past it. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez takes us to a pioneer place.
Elliot, Warner, Dobson, I'm not talking about street names. These are people who helped develop the East Valley, and they are buried at the Tempe Double Butte Cemetery. It sits adjacent to the I-10 and at the foothills of the Buttes Resort. Did you know the Butte Cemetery is one of the oldest in the valley and the resting place of many influential valley pioneers?
First burials here, or at least first recorded burials, were 1888.
John Southard is an Arizona historian and the preservationist for the city of Tempe.
91 Tempe pioneers are listed in a book detailing those who were prominent in early Tempe. Of those, something like 82 are buried here in the cemetery, so it was the burying ground.
Southard says before there was a cemetery, it was customary to bury relatives on family-owned properties. But as Tempe began growing, lands were being sold and developed. So a local prominent landowner donated part of his land far away from the town to use as its cemetery.
This cemetery varies greatly from those you'd find back east, the more traditional.
The Butte Cemetery has been maintained by the city of Tempe since the 1950s, after the association that cared for it dissolved. The land is about 40 acres. Most of it is lush green. One area has a Sonoran desert landscape. The space is called the Pioneer Section.
It was families of the dead who were largely responsible for maintaining the grounds. That's why you see the widespread variety of plots here, some with simple cement borders, some with chain link fences, some with wrought iron fences, some really quite ornate, others very humble.
Walk through the cemetery pathways and you'll see familiar names.
Charles Hayden, the Anglo founder of Tempe, to his son, Senator Carl Hayden, to Governor Benjamin B. Moore, the governor who created the Arizona Navy. If you walk around here, you can really see the street grid of the Southeast Valley play out in terms of the names you'll find on the gravestones.
Like Reginald Elliott and Samuel Warner, they were prominent landowners in South Tempe. City records show Pioneer Section at the Butte Cemetery is also the resting place of local veterans who served as long ago as the Civil War. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez.
And if you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
Well, if you're looking for something to do tonight and you're a Cincinnati Reds fan, there happens to be one right sitting in my chair.
No.
You can see them play the Arizona Diamondbacks tonight, Saturday night, or Sunday afternoon.
If you like the Blues Review Band is playing tonight, 8 p.m. at Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts.
The show was produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Anika Klein, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Regina Rebazova, and Tiara Vian. Tracy Greer, Sky Schaut, Maria Springs of the digital team. Our news director is Al Macias. The executive producer is John Hoban. We do want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know about good story ideas. You can find us at the show at kjzz.org. You can also download the KJZZ app to your smartphone. For Phil Latzman and Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. All Things Considered is up next. Have a great weekend. It's 3 o'clock.